Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar on tracking and ending religious discrimination featuring Professor Nicole Stell Garnett and Professor Michael Helfand. Our moderator today is Professor Michael Moreland. Dr. Moreland is a university professor of law and religion and director of the Eleanor H. McCullen Center for Law, Religion, and Public Policy at Villanova University Charles Widger School of Law, where he has taught since 2006, including a period as vice dean. Before joining the Villanova faculty, he served as Associate Director for Domestic Policy at the White House under President George W. Bush. A renowned scholar, Dr. Moreland frequently provides commentary in the media at conferences and before Congress, and his writings appear in numerous publications. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Michael, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco, and thank you all for joining us for this important discussion about religious discrimination and remedies to it. I'll briefly introduce our two speakers and then open it up for a conversation. We will aim to leave some time at the end for questions, which again you can put through the Q&A function at the bottom of the window, and we'll try to get to as many questions as we can. Professor Nicole Stell Garnett is the John P. Murphy Foundation Professor of Law at Notre Dame Law School, where she also serves as the Associate Dean for External Engagement and directs the Notre Dame Education Law Project. Her teaching and research focus on education law and policy, religious liberty, and topics related to property law, especially land use and urban development policies. Professor Michael Helfand is the Brendan Mann Foundation Chair in Law and Religion and co-director of the Neutbar Institute for Law, Religion, and Ethics at Pepperdine Caruso School of Law. During the spring, right now, he serves as the Florence Rogatz Visiting Professor at Yale Law School. In addition to these academic appointments, Professor Helfand serves as the Senior Legal Advisor to the Orthodox Union's Teach Coalition and is a Senior Fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute. Welcome, Professor Garnett and Professor Helfand.
Thanks so much.
So as mentioned, we're talking about religious discrimination, and the proximate cause for our gathering this webinar is a new project that Professors Garnett and Helfand are part of, which is a website, religiousequality.net, that you can look at. But Professor Garnett, maybe you could start by talking about what the project is, what it's aiming to do, and then I'll turn to Professor Helfand to provide maybe a little context for why this project is especially timely given some recent Supreme Court opinions.
So the project, it aims for now, eventually we'd hope to expand to federal programs. But right now what it aims to do is it aims to identify as many state and state regulations and state statutes that unconstitutionally exclude religious organizations or religious conduct from public benefit programs. So there's a series of recent Supreme Court cases that culminated in a case called Carson versus Macon in 2022 that basically sets a very clear ground rule that if the government sets up a program that engages with private organizations, the private organization, the program can't discriminate against religious organizations by excluding them, nor can it say you must secularize your behavior in order to participate. So I had an insight around Carson time that there might be a lot of unconstitutional laws and regulations out there. And so I sort of undertook to try to find as many as possible. And at that point, I started talking to Michael, Professor Helfin, about this. And we thought it would be it's a pretty massive undertaking to find them all. We found close to 600 at just the state level. But we thought maybe this would be a great opportunity for Notre Dame's Religious Liberty Clinic and Education Law Project to partner with the Orthodox Union. We both have interest in eliminating unconstitutional religious discrimination. And that's sort of the origin for the project. And, you know, 18 months later, we have this website that we're quite proud of. It's pretty nifty if you're looking at it.
Professor Helfin, just for our audience, maybe who have attended other webinars by our practice group, the Religious Liberties Practice Group, but some might be somewhat newer to these issues. Maybe you could just say a little bit about kind of framing for us the recent Supreme Court line of cases, Trinity Lutheran, Espinoza, and Carson versus Macon, and how, there are other programs that have talked about those cases in great detail, but maybe in a summary way, kind of talk about why those cases sort of set the framework for work that this website is trying to engage in.
Sure. That sounds, let me say a little bit about that. And Michael, thanks again for hosting. Really wonderful to be here and to hang out with my partner in crime, Nicole Garnett. So maybe one way to think about what's going on in this area is to take a step back before 2017, before Trinity Lutheran v. Comer. I think this is obvious to many people who will be part of this, have been on these webinars, but, you know, the practical piece of it, which was really Nicole's insight, the practical piece of it may not have been as obvious to everyone. So for, you know, post Lemon v. Kurtzman, 1971, states are enacting legislation increasingly. They're promulgating regulations around a wide variety of benefit programs, including in particular many programs related to education and more recent years security. They live in a world of, you know, constitutional law, but that's almost secondary. Primarily, legislatures are just doing stuff. They're writing things. They're enacting laws. And each time they enact a program, in their minds, you know, Lemon v. Kurtzman is the law. And that means if they're enacting a public benefit program, they need to make sure to do everything that they're supposed to do. They need to cross their T's and dot their I's. And what that means for the 1970s and 80s and 90s, sort of, is that you need to make sure that none of that money ends up in the hands of religious institutions, because Lemon v. Kurtzman says you can't have a religious purpose, or you have to have a secular purpose. You can't advance religion through a public benefit program. And so those are the ground rules. Now, if you pause about that for, you know, and think about that for a few minutes, what that means is for 30 years, we just have tons and tons of legislation where, you know, somebody in the legislature, whether the legislative council is like, guys, before you do this, remember that stamp that we have that says, but not for religion. That's the thing that makes sure it's constitutional. And so they all keep on doing this. And then in 2007, in the early 2000s, we learn Lemon v. Kurtzman probably isn't the law of the land with respect to the Establishment Clause. Already, we probably see that in Zelman v. Simmons-Harris in 2002. You start rolling through Locke v. Davy. We're not 100% sure. Maybe the state can exclude religion, but it doesn't have to. And by the time you get to 2017, the Supreme Court has started to say pretty clearly that once you have a program that is neutral, it doesn't privilege religion, but you have a public benefit program that goes to private institutions. First, in 2017, the Supreme Court says you can't exclude religious institutions based on their status. And then in 2022, the Supreme Court makes clear in Carson v. Macon that you also can't exclude institutions just because they're going to use the funds for religious purposes. Here's the problem and the crux of the website and the federal laws that we'll hopefully be able to put on the website within the next 6 months or who knows what. The crux of it is nobody told everybody to fix what was on the books. You've got decades and decades of stuff, and I don't know, it's a lot. And nobody's responsible to make sure that now that the law has changed, constitutional law has changed, that we've updated our statutes accordingly. And so kind of the big puzzle and the challenge that the website is intended to present is, The problem is bigger than you think. It's pretty massive. There are lots of individuals and institutions and faith communities that are unable to, as a result, make use of funds for very important purposes, pre-K, special needs families, healthcare, social services. And as a result, the unconstitutional laws that are now on the books are having devastating consequences in all areas of legislation. And I guess we felt very passionately that what had to happen was, in order to remedy this, one thing that had to happen was there had to be some sort of place that people could go to see the scope of the problem so that they could figure out what actions they needed to take.
So, Michael, can I just follow up one thing? I mean, I do agree. I also call what Michael Helfand just called described as lemon think. I mean, the state statutes and federal law is probably worse. It's just infected with lemon think. And it's, so we have to, religion is icky. It's unconstitutional to give money to religion. There's another kind of thinking that's going on in the states, and that's Blaine think. So these three recent cases, Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza in particular, they make clear that the state Blaine amendments are established anti-establishment provisions cannot be used as an excuse for religious discrimination. But the states that are enacting all of these laws that Michael described, they're also saying, oh, the double check is, remember, we have a Blaine Amendment, and so we really can't, we really must discriminate against religion. And no one has, the bat signal has not gotten yet down into the states that these things are not enforceable. And so I think that there's this really old bad law hangover that haunts a lot of these state statutes. And like Michael said, our goal is to bring them to light so that we can get some reform.
So maybe, Professor Garnett, maybe you could speak a little bit about, Michael Helfand started discussing it, but maybe some of the specific areas we're talking about. So, of course, Trinity Lutheran was a case about playground resurfacing with scrap tires. Espinoza and Carson involved tuition scholarship programs at private schools. But as you look at this website, religiousequality.net, and I was clicking on Pennsylvania, for example, where I am right now, and you can click on every state and kind of see different aspects of this issue, but what are some of the other areas, education related, but others as well, where these issues are most prevalent?
Right. So the majority of the ones that we find are education related. So big buckets in education are special needs. So particularly, there's sometimes public schools can't provide an acceptable education for special needs children. They get a private placement, maybe because the states think that federal law makes them. Many, many states say you may not send your child to a religious school, even though you're entitled to have your child under federal and state law educated by a private school. It can't be religious. There are many states discriminate or at least require publicly funded pre-K programs to be secular. So even states with voucher and ESA laws that allow parents to send their kids to private K-12 schools and discriminate against private religious preschools. My favorite line is from Iowa. It says there, in the pre-K program that's publicly funded, there can be no sprinkling of religion throughout the day. There are limits on scholarships, some of which seem to reflect Locke versus Davey. He'll say you can get a scholarship, but not if you study theology. Or only if your school has a secular purpose. You can get, there's some weird ones that restrict work study. So you can get work study, but not for doing religious stuff. You can get, co-curricular credit in high school, but not at a religious college. There's a lot of education related ones. There are also some community development and social services ones. You can get money to build a home for older poor people, but not if it has a chapel or not if it has a religious purpose. You could have a job training program, a prison reentry program, all these things that say, either they say you cannot be religious or you can't do anything religious or you have to promise not to do religious things in order to participate. And then there's just some really wacky ones. Michael probably could bring out some of his favorites, but I think my very favorite was, there's one in Alabama that says you can give away money from Greyhound racing days, but not to charities unless they're religious. There's weird restrictions on, in Georgia, if you're a The state has a program where it encourages people like a United Way that work for Georgia to give money to charities, but they can't be religious. So there's sort of strange ones that don't really have any particular explanation. But I mean, what's your favorite, Michael?
I think my favorite is Massachusetts, which prohibits if the army has food that's going to spoil, they can give it to charities that will dispense it to people who are in need, unless those charities are religious, because we wouldn't want the food that goes to the people who are in need that's otherwise going to spoil to have a pit stop at a religious institution to disperse it. I think that's my personal favorite. I probably pick it because I find it particularly offensive.
Good. Following on that, Michael Helfand, maybe talk a little bit, if we can continue talking about some examples that the website points to about some of these issues that we're talking about. But of course, the objective here is to find ways to remedy this kind of discrimination that is shot through different state and federal law. And sort of the strategies or the avenues through which that can be undone. And it strikes me that there's would be litigation challenges. You could have state legislation. You can have state executive agency action. So maybe you could talk a little bit about ways in which people who are interested in engaging in this kind of work can go about doing it. And maybe talk a little bit about your own post-Carson work in litigation and other settings.
Happy to. So I'll address the litigation side of the ledger. I really came to this issue certainly didn't have Nicole's insight about the pervasiveness of the problem and where we'd find it in all the states and all the these kind of curious, I don't know, black holes of constitutional law, it feels like. I got approached actually a couple of years back by my own, I'm Orthodox Jewish, I do work with the Orthodox Union, and a group of people trying to figure out how to deal with their special needs children, trying to get them the services they need out in Los Angeles. And one of the things that was super curious, somebody came to me and said, you know, we've been looking at the laws here. What does the word sectarian mean? And I'm like, oh, let me see that. And it turns out in California, there's a rule in the special education context. So individuals with disabilities, with Disabilities Education Act, federal government gives money to the states. And then the states are obligated to provide a free, appropriate public education to every single child as a result. If they can't do it, they're supposed to contract with a private school that can provide a FAPE, the kind of education that the child deserves and is legally entitled to. To do that, to be that kind of partner, to have the state or the school district refer a child to the school, you have to become, let's call it, a state certified special needs school. And you could not become state certified special needs school if you were sectarian. And this is why, you know, I know just from my own faith community, many, many special needs families that are Jewish in California, they just move, they leave the state because they can't quite get the kind of education for the children that that they want. And there was a desire, given Carson B. Macon, to file suit against California. And one of the curious things about it, and really just goes to like Nicole's incisive point about the lemon thing, when we went before the district court, we lost. And we lost, this is a case, Loughman v. California Department of Education. We lost because sometimes it just feels like you can't explain to the judge that, you know, please forgive me, I probably shouldn't say it this way. It's not 1971. So just got a, you know, a little bit of an update. So as a result, when we went before the Ninth Circuit, unanimous panel found in our favor that the preliminary injunction, we were likely to succeed on the merits. And that's kind of the current state of play. But you see this, and I guess for me, the reason I tell the story the way I do was I still remember the first meeting we had with all those Jewish special needs families. I mean, I probably will remember that meeting for the rest of my life. It's awful. just awful. And it's not just there. The Pepperdine Religious Liberty Clinic has also been pressing this issue in New Jersey, historic preservation grants. This has been an issue for a long time. New Jersey, Morris County provides a county in New Jersey. Another kind of, I'd say, very important case if you're trying to track the litigation front of this issue. Morris County gives out money to old important buildings, and originally they gave them out to churches until the New Jersey Supreme Court said our state constitutional provision says that you can't give them to churches. So they took the money back. But then Carson V. Macon showed up on the scene. And so the Pepperdine Religious Liberty Clinic, along with First Liberty, has filed suit again to say the law is different again. And what you need to do is you need to provide the money again, neutrally. You have to assess each institution to see if they are indeed important and old. But then you should do so regardless of whether or not they're religious. So you see these kinds of cases. And just one of the interesting things is the decisions coming from judges. This isn't kind of it's, for lack of a better way of describing it, across the ideological spectrum, judges are, you know, recognizing the law and I think deciding accordingly by and large. The challenge is if you just have litigation, and I suspect I'm looking forward to Nicole's comments on the legislative side. You know, we've identified, you know, let's say around 500, 600 regulations and statutes. Constitutional whack-a-mole is a long road. And one would hope at a certain point that there was a better way to do business. And, you know, in some ways to make this, all this information, put it in the public domain, the goal of it is to maybe find a better way. And maybe I'll pass the baton on that point.
It's also important. I want to mention one other case because I think it's so outrageous. But there's a, you know, it's important to keep in mind that, I mean, even people who are hurt by these regulations, there's a cost to being a plaintiff. And even if you get pro bono, great religious liberty pro bono counsel, you know, you're causing trouble for your community. You know, why are you doing this? So I just think that it's a risk for families and people, real people, or maybe some of these charities that have been taking the money and agreeing to secularize. They would prefer to be fully religious. But the last thing they want to do is sue the government and risk losing their grant altogether. The other case, this is an illustration of the problem. The case Michael didn't mention was a case out of New York where a Jewish family who had a special needs child was placed in was placed in a religious school. That's what New York was doing, but they were taking 30% off the money of the school the child was entitled to, because that was kind of their rough cut about how much was going to be spent on religion. So they were just knocking 30% off. And this family filed like some kind of an administrative law complaint, and they won. And the judge, the ALJ in New York said, yeah, you know what, you're right, you get it all. And now the city or the state, they're suing the family in federal court to get the money back for their autistic child in a Jewish school. So, I mean, it's really, I think hopefully that will come out the right way, the Second Circuit. In addition to litigation, I think the easiest thing to do is legislation. These are easy fixes. If you were just to go through state statutes and look for the words sectarian and non-sectarian, you could easily conform the law fairly easily, pretty comprehensively. You could pass a statute that says we aren't going to violate Carson versus Macon religious discrimination. You could do a cleanup statute. I think, you know, in a lot of states there would be an appetite for doing exactly that. And Michael mentioned you could have executive action. That could be an attorney general opinion, or just a week ago, the governor of Oklahoma issued an executive order, Governor Stitt, basically taking this idea and running with it and saying, okay, so Carson versus Macon, we're not going to do this anymore. Also, every agency head, go through all of your programs, all of your policies, all of your regulations, and all of your contracts, and report back to me what you find. And then we're going to stop it. And then, by the way, these five or six things, they don't look good. So we're going to stop them now. So it was a really nice model for just saying, you know, we're not going to do this. I think, to Michael's point about not knowing, not Professor Helfand's point, a lot of these states don't have any interest in religious discrimination. They just don't know they're doing it. I doubt that states with voucher programs that allow religious schools to participate really care if pre-K programs, that the pre-K program is, you know, requiring religious preschools to be secular schools. So I just think that one of the goals here is law reform, and at the state level, and then we also hope at the federal level.
Well, speaking of the federal level and agency action, so Professor Garnett, you in November with your Notre Dame colleague John Meeser had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal talking about actions that the incoming Trump administration could take on this front. And just on April 9th, yesterday, there was a presidential memorandum that requires agencies to rescind regulations that are unlawful under recent landmark Supreme Court decisions, and there are 10 such cases that the White House identifies, one of which is Carson v. Macon, and I'll just quote from the memorandum here. Carson v. Macon held that a law excluding religious schools from participating in Maine's school voucher program violated the Free Exercise Clause. Agencies accordingly must review their regulations to ensure equal treatment of religious institutions vis-a-vis secular institutions for purposes of funding and access to public benefits. And then the next case identified in the memorandum is Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn versus Cuomo, which again, quoting from the memorandum, struck down New York's COVID-era occupancy restrictions on churches and synagogues because they were uniquely harsher than those that applied to essential businesses such as acupuncture facilities. Each agency should review its regulations to ensure at least equal treatment of religious institutions vis-a-vis secular institutions for regulatory purposes. So that's a presidential memorandum. So maybe, Professor Garnett, you could say a little bit, building on your op-ed piece from the Wall Street Journal and this memorandum, about the federal level, because we've mostly been talking about state programs, and this website identifies a lot of state issues. What about at the federal level? What are some of the some of these issues that this memorandum is targeting?
Right. So the op-ed that I wrote with my colleague, John Beezer, who's also a partner on this project, he runs our religious liberty clinic here at Notre Dame, it was called Trump Can End Religious Discrimination. And it basically suggested that the president could do what Governor Stitt did last week and issued an executive order sort of asking his all the agencies to look for this stuff and report back to him. And then there would be some kind of a, you know, an executive order that would say, stop doing it. What he did was a lot bigger than that. He just said, there's not just one case, which I was just worried about one case. There are 10. And he says, don't report back, identify them, and then issue non-enforcement orders if you find any policies or practices or regulations that violate these, that run afoul of these 10 cases, which include not just religion, but the major questions doctrine, recent takings cases. It's a pretty sweeping regulatory cleanup effort. So as far as the Carson regulation and the post-Carson world of federal regulations, I do have a lot of work. We've been doing research on that. I have a kind of unwieldy spreadsheet that we're trying to figure out what to do with. I will say the problem is at least as pervasive in the federal law as it is in state law. And some of the state law problems probably stem from either implied, assumed or direct orders from the federal government. I would just use the example of all federal equitable services to children in private schools. So the federal education funding statutes, IDEA, plus the title statutes, Title I, Title II, Title III, that provide equitable services for mostly for disadvantaged kids. The way they work is they give the school districts money and they have an obligation to share that money equitably with private school children. And those, so that goes to tutoring, teacher professional development, English language learners, special education. And even if those services are provided by private religious schools, the services must be secular. Actually, technically, the term of art is secular, neutral, and non-ideological. Those words originated in Lemon, and they get repeated the next year in Nyquist, so they're kind of outdated. And so what happens a lot of times in the state laws is they just throw those words on top of their own education statutes. So I think that it would make a huge difference in the lives of millions of people if we could get rid of that requirement. Because first of all, if the schools provide the services themselves, they have to, you know, go to the trouble of proving they're not spending it on religion. If they don't, they either do one of two things. Either the school districts provide the services, which is what they like to do, so they can keep the money, or they're consultants that provide the services to the religious schools in a secular way, and that's expensive when the schools could just be doing it themselves, leaving aside all that rigmarole and So we're talking billions of dollars of federal education funds. That's just one part of it. I noticed one of the questions was about the charitable choice during George W. Bush. So George W. Bush's charitable choice programs really did try to encourage the religious providers to participate fully in publicly funded social service programs. But because, as Michael Helfand points out, they thought they couldn't pay for religion, all of those programs say you can be religious, but all of your religion must be off the books. So if you want to, if you want to pray before, you know, your meal at the soup kitchen, you can't, that moment of time can't be federally funded, or you have to have your worship service later. So there are all of those restrictions, the charitable choice provisions. And that's a really interesting one to me. I was talking to John Meeser about this. It seems that in that motivation, there was actually pro-religion. It was to try to maximize the opportunities for religious organizations to participate. But there was a belief that you couldn't fund religion. And now after Carson, it's pretty clear that you can't require them to secularize in that way. A lot of restrictions on services provided through USAID. Those may be moot now because maybe we're not doing that stuff anymore. But throughout, you would be surprised. I mean, I have a spreadsheet. Every agency has some program that they're administering that they have some restrictions on federal funds going to religious organizations or religious entities. And again, I think a lot of this is just lemon think that is baked into federal law. The first Trump administration did a little bit of cleanup. They issued a few OLC opinions. One was about HBCUs, one was about charter schools, and one was about, hilariously, Christmas decorations. But, you know, that was just a few. And then, I mean, maybe Michael wants to talk about the Cuomo case. I mean, I think that's a tougher one. So that case, the second case you mentioned, was a COVID era case where they were saying, if you're a church or a synagogue, you could only be at a quarter capacity. But if you're a bowling alley, you could be at a half capacity. And the court basically establishes the rule that religious organizations have to be treated at least as well as non-religious organizations in religion, regardless of whether they're getting money. That applies to everything. And I do think that's sometimes called the most favored nation rule or status for religious organizations. I'm sure there are a lot of federal law violations of that. I think they're a lot harder to find than religious discrimination. So I don't have any particular, our project doesn't extend to that. I don't have any particular strategies or sense of the scope of the problem. I don't know if you do, Michael.
Happy to say something on the last point, then maybe circle back. I have this sneaking suspicion that if they're actually to clean up all the Carson v. Macon problems, you'd eliminate pretty much everything that you could find under the Cuomo bucket. And I say that because, you know, if you're looking through regulations and statutes, or in this case regulations, what you're dealing with is issues that are on their face, exclusions that are on their face. And if that's what we're dealing with, so then that'll really be picked up by the Carson v. Macon kind of bucket and identifying exclusions of religion. The kind of other issues that sometimes the Cuomo most favored nation status might actually pick up, that would be, I suspect, what would be beyond it would be kind of as applied, something going on that you wouldn't see just by looking at the regulation or statute. So My suspicion is that the two buckets may actually collapse quite a bit if they're just looking through regulations and eventually looking through statutes. But I guess time will tell.
Yeah, I wonder, we thought about trying to do this early on and we couldn't figure out how, but I suspect that there are a huge amount of problems in RFPs and government contracts that are, you know, I don't know how to, there's no public database, maybe there is, but I suspect that if like OIRA started reviewing those things, they would catch it. But I suspect, you know, like there are a lot of contracts that have been around for a long time, and they probably have both problems sort of baked into them, because they're actually treating religious organizations worse than like private organizations because they think they have to, like the knocking the 30% off for religion in the Jewish day school for the disabled kid. That's treating religious organizations differently than a secular organization, but it's a Carson problem also.
And you wouldn't see it, by the way, from on the face of any particular like when you try to find the rule that authorizes that deduction, you can't, it's very challenging to find. It's usually just deduced from either, you know, some sort of no aid provision, no aid to religion provision or something along those lines. I did actually want to follow up on that. And the name of that case, if I recall correctly, is Board of Regents v. EL. And, you know, one of the things that people often, when they first encounter this, their gut reaction is, but wait a minute, like, religion isn't advancing the goals of the program. Like the goal of the program is X. And if we fund the religious institution, it's that that's not what the goal of the program is. And I actually think Board of Regents v. EL is a really excellent example of maybe, you know, how we should be thinking about these issues. You know, in that case, the initial administrative law judge, and then the second, the first one who just did the fact finding, that ALJ said, you know, all of the education, including the religious education, is advancing the pedagogical goals of the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It's just that some of it was done while reading the Bible and some of it was done while, you know, something else. But all of the education was advancing the goals of the program. And after that factual finding, then the ALJ says, but even though some of this is advancing the goals of the program, because it's religious, we're going to reduce the amount of tuition that goes to the religious school. Now, I think the Carson v. Macon instinct is it asks government to think carefully about not what is and is not religious, but what kinds of activities are advancing the goals of the program. It may indeed be the case that some certain kinds of religious instruction don't advance the goals of the program, but the best way to describe that wouldn't be by drawing a line between religion and non-religion. The way to describe that problem would be to carefully articulate the goal of the program and then try to determine whether or not the activities being funded actually advance it. That's the non-discriminatory way to do the same thing. And again, Board of Regents v. EL is an excellent example because there the ALJ says, well, we can't fund this even though there's a finding on the record that it's advancing the goals of the program. And I think that in many ways is what the website is getting at. It's trying to say, change the way you think about the legislation and regulations you're putting on the books. We're not saying don't regulate. What we're saying is regulate based on the goals of the program, not kind of using what I would almost describe as legislative lazy tactics of saying, we're not going to think deeply about what the goal of the program is. Religion's out because it's something different and we don't remember why, and let's move on.
One thing before the next question, I do also really want to emphasize, because maybe we have Hill staffers here. I mean, the president in his remarks about the executive order did say, I didn't watch them, but somebody told me this. You know, it's Congress needs to take care of these problems too. I mean, I do think it's a lot of these things are in federal statutes, secular, neutral, non-ideological. I mean, some of these things are baked into federal statutes. They're not just regulatory. They can't just easily, they can have non-enforcement. But if you really want to end it permanently, both in the states and at the federal level, ending it legislatively is the best way to ensure long-term, so the next person in charge doesn't just say, well, we're going to enforce that again, and then you have to go back to court.
By way of expanding out a little bit of the discussion, we focused a lot on education. I did notice the Oklahoma governor's executive order also mentioned arts funding and historical preservation. Any examples from those areas that either of you can speak to?
So the New Jersey historical preservation one is a good example. We did find in our cat, if you're looking at the website under other, that's the sort of catch all. So there are some strange ones on arts. Educate arts funding, so you could have museums that, you know, that had cultural, you funded cultural things, and you can't fund the museum if it's got a religious purpose or religious, I don't know exactly. It wasn't always clear what some of those meant, like, because I mean, you can't put religious art in the museum, and that can't be true. So the arts funding, historic preservation, there were a number of states that had historic preservation restrictions that would basically say, like, you know, if it's an old important building, you can get money to preserve it, but not if it's a synagogue or a church. Some of the others, I mean, so, and you know, Oklahoma was not, if I remember correctly, the worst offender. by any stretch of the imagination. But I do think here, again, there must have been some kind of thinking like, well, if we help the church, you know, get new pews, you know, that's definitely not a secular purpose. So that violates Lemon. There's another thing that's going on in some of these is really not about, I think a lot of work, there's clearly some of them that have the sense, it's sort of almost like the case from the Tilton case, is that what it's called? Like you can give religious organizations, maybe give them a building or help them build a building, but like a lab. But if it has a chapel, you know, if it's a science building with a chapel, I can't do that. It's super bad. So there's a lot of, community development, economic development grants, where it seems to be saying, we'll let you have some money to do good things and build buildings and maybe higher ed, like, you know, build a dorm, but no chapel in the dorm, because that would be unconstitutional. And I think that is also goes back to this old thinking that you could maybe support religious organizations that weren't pervasively sectarian, that old term. And you could trust them with the money to not do religious stuff. But once they cross that line, there's like any religious instruction, the building has any religious purpose, you can't have the building. I don't think that's the constitutional ruling. I think the opposite is true, but there's a lot of that. A lot of those. One last one I will say that I found really odd is that some of the healthcare laws say that even hospitals that are religious have to have non-sectarian boards. I don't know what that means, but I mean, it's a sort of like, how can you tell a religious hospital it has to, like, Catholic hospital has to have, like, what does that mean? Like, you have two Jews and, you know, a Methodist or one atheist, and, you know, I don't know. So I just think they thought they were making it up. They thought they had to do it, and they just put this weird stuff in the law that needs to be out of the law.
Maybe I'll just throw two quick things in. If you're looking, Michael, and for some examples, I just pulled up like a little sheet I have. Arkansas gives grants up to $2,500 for museums, but not a theme museum. Either is religious or promotes religious principles. New Jersey has $10,000 grants for privately operated nonprofit art centers, but not if those art centers are in some way religious, and that's consistent. New Jersey has pretty strong no aid to religion. It has a state constitutional provision that it enforces pretty rigorously. And, you know, to Nicole's point about kind of Tilton v. Richardson and its legacy in terms of buildings, I think sometimes people hear that and they're like, yeah, the government's funding something and it shouldn't have a chapel in it. And, you know, I want to just go back again to like the instinct that I really think we need to, is worth thinking about a little bit. What is the government saying at that point? We're going to fund a building, and it might want to say, and we only want you to use it for science. Like, that's what we're doing, and we don't want you using it for other purposes, because that's our goal. That's our goal in providing this sort of funding. And that seems perfectly reasonable. We're providing funding to a building. You can only use it for science. And that means you can't use it for religion, but you can't use it for yoga, and you can't use it for, you know, for your sports team. And that's all fine. That kind of affirmative thinking about the goals of funding and the program seems perfectly reasonable. What's odd is like, well, we don't want this money diverted, but the only thing we don't want it diverted to is religion. But you can use it for anything else. You want to, you know, throw a graduation party there, have at it. That's fine. And I think that's kind of the Carson instinct that requires, I think, serious, as Nicole said, serious legislative thinking about what we're trying to accomplish with certain public benefit programs. And again, not this laziness that as long as we kind of say, but no religion, we're being true to the goals of government programs.
Again, if anyone has questions, please put them in the Q&A box, and we will get to them in just a moment. I did think, just building on what Professor Helfand was just saying there a moment ago, that maybe it's a law professor's trick, but to say, you know, what would the skeptics say here? I suppose one line would be, of course, to reject Carson, and Justice Sotomayor wrote a strong dissent in that case. What would the other kind of arguments be that others might adduce, and what would your responses be to them?
So I think the skeptics, there are two things that if you're sort of like, well, what I think are not true anymore, but so one might be, well, some of this stuff is just allowed under Locke versus Davey. So it may not be unconstitutional. Maybe it's like stupid. But you know, a lot of these statutes in higher ed seem to be kind of, the hook is Locke v. Davey. So the ones that say you can go to any college unless it lacks a secular purpose, or, you know, religion pervades everything. Or the ones that say you can get the scholarship, but not if you're studying theology. And then, you know, my response to that is, it seems pretty clear after Carson that Locke versus Davey is pretty much cabin to its facts. I mean, it says like, this is the state's interest in not paying for ministered training. But I will say, if anybody wants to get rid of Locke versus Davey, this is a ripe, there's a lot of good lawsuits in this, on this website. I think the other one that Michael and I have talked about is, you know, is there, to what extent is sort of the direct indirect funding distinction doing work? Some, I mean, the buildings are clearly direct. I mean, so if the grant is just cash to a religious organization, does the religious organization, does the establishment clause still require no religious content because there's no intervening private choice about how the money gets spent? I don't think that's true. I mean, Trinity Lutheran was certainly not an indirect funding case. Lots of, I mean, hundreds of billions of dollars flowed to religious organizations during COVID. And no one said, oh, those are direct grants to, you know, pay for Catholic school teachers' salaries. So I don't think that is, I mean, that would be the two, I think the easiest skeptical things there are. Yeah. So I think, I don't know if Michael has other ideas, but I think those are the two maybe critiques, but I think they're both wrong.
Yeah, I agree with that. And maybe I'd add to the list. There is this worry, I'd say long-term. I was talking to a reporter today that, you know, some of this came up. There's this instinct, and therefore, are you saying that we just can't regulate? And I don't think that's the right answer either. And, you know, I suspect if the three of us chatted through all the different kinds of regulations we thought were okay or not okay, we, you know, we might come up with different lists. But the basic baseline, I think, remains that to the extent government puts regulations on programs that aren't targeting religion, they're neutral. So it's not like a situation where, you know, they enact some sort of change to the law and the regulation because now religion has to be included. And maybe they say on the front page of the New York Times, we're doing it to go after religion. That's probably a bad idea if you're litigating. But that doesn't mean, you know, the variety of ways in which I think government, and I'm really trying to push this point, like government can still engage in neutral regulation that's applicable across the board, that certainly if to the extent, and Michael, and this is, you know, goes back to our unconstitutional conditions conversation, certainly is geared towards the goals of the program. So think deeply about the program, think deeply about what it is you want. Nobody here is saying regulation is off the table. It just needs to be tethered to what you're trying to accomplish, as opposed to tethered to, you know, a 1971 Supreme Court opinion.
So, Michael Moreland, that is, Professor Moreland, when we were thinking about the contours of this project, we decided to limit the hits that we were identifying to programs that actually discriminate against religious organizations or religious conduct. We decided not to wade into the thicket of unconstitutional conditions. I mean, there are claims, you know, that this regulation, which may sort of look neutral on its face, actually has the effect of discriminating against religion. I mean, after Carson, Maine adopted regulations that are now being challenged, it's in the First Circuit that did various things that caused most religious schools not to participate. And one of them was, it said, if you want to teach religion, that's fine. But once you teach any religion, you have to allow all religions. So I guess it means like the Catholics have to let people say the Pope is the whore of Babylon, or the Jews have to let the Jews for Jesus have their day. I mean, in my view, that is religious discrimination, but we chose not to go down that road because it just gets too complicated too quickly. But Michael Helfand's right. I mean, the state of Indiana has a voucher program that covers almost all children. And in order to participate, you have to take the state test. some people don't like that. And in fact, most private school choice programs don't have that rule. But that certainly doesn't discriminate against religion. There's certainly no unconstitutional conditions problem with saying, look, if I'm going to give you $6,000 a kid, everybody's taking the state test. That might be a terrible education policy to say. I still think it's unconstitutional. I do think there's a lot that out there, other questions that will be tackled by others.
Maybe can I chime in on one, one minor point, just following up. And it's like meta discrimination. And the fact that states think they can solve the substantive problems of what the legislation is supposed to accomplish by going after religion is, if you ask about the underlying assumptions, you can see how that surfaces a certain kind of discrimination on its own. This perception that that is what is persona non grata. And, you know, Nicole, we've chatted about this a bunch. Like, this is why I just, my faith community, the Orthodox Jewish community, has really pressed very hard on this issue already since the 1960s. I mean, and this was at a time when I'd say the politics of these issues looked very, very different. But Orthodox Jews have for a long time perceived that not only is it the case, and this is, you can find this in congressional testimony again, that goes back all the way to 1961, that not only is it that funds and benefits were off the table because of their religious commitments and affiliations, but that there was something almost nefarious about this, that it meant that it undermined the principle of equal citizenship, that even if there wasn't really much money on the table, the idea that we would contort programs and think we were solving their assuring their ultimate goal merely by excluding those with religious commitments, there's something about that was deeply problematic. And, you know, again, different faith communities have, you know, their commitment to this point has, I'd say, ebbed and flowed over time in a variety of ways, not the Catholic community, but, you know, others.
The OG complainers.
That's right. I think maybe this is why Nicole and I hang out so much. We are the OG complainers. We didn't have websites, though, back in the early 1960s. I think that's at the core of it. The core of it, and the reason why it's been such a consistent complaint is because it's money is money and people can raise it, but kind of the damage it does to principles of equal citizenship stay. And have deeply disturbing effects. And I think, you know, to some extent, this website is an attempt to surface those and find ways to solve both kinds of problems.
Great. Well, I do want to get some audience questions. And actually, one was about the post-Carson, as the questioner asked, phenomenon of states changing their non-discrimination requirements to gerrymander religious institutions out of public benefits programs. That's the unconstitutional conditions issue that we talked about a little bit. Here's another question. If a religious organization wins the grant and is the only provider of the service in an area, is it a problem that some proportion of the intended beneficiaries may have a religious objection to receiving a service filled with teaching and activities of the provider's religion?
Well, so that's an interesting question. In something that I've written about elsewhere, called Biden Boils the Religious Liberty Frog. There was a Biden administration regulation of charitable choice that made it harder for institutions to remain faithful. They actually tried to jerry-rig the line between direct and indirect based upon the number of providers in an area. So to this question, my answer is the non-discrimination rule applies. It's not the neutrality principle, as Zelman points out, it's not really an empirical question. That is to say, the question in Zelman, if back to the original voucher case, the argument the dissent made, Justice Souter very strongly, was there really wasn't a choice here because the parents, there was only, you know, 96% of the kids were in religious schools. I can remember 90% of the schools were religious. And their choice was like, go to your crappy public, you know, Cleveland public schools or go to this religious school. And the answer that the court gives in that case is that the constitutionality of a rule or what neutrality is can't turn on local demographics, because, you know, then parental choice would be better, okay, in New York, but not in Kansas. So I think that's the answer to the question. Obviously, the government can choose to provide the services itself. I just don't think that it can say, we want to make sure there's a non-religious option. And since there's only one, you know, only one person is bidding, that's not less than ideal in any bidding situation. We're just going to say no because they're religious. We're going to require them to not secularize. I think there's another question that we really don't address, and I think it's a harder one. It's an unconstitutional conditions type question, is whether you can require the recipients to let religious, non-religious or objectors or people who don't want to do a religion opt out. Opt-outs are difficult in some situations for some religions because there's really no non-Jesus time, right? So it's really hard to say you get to opt out of religion in a Catholic school. I mean, ideally, in my faith tradition, Catholicism pervades everything. So they're really, you could say you don't have to go to mass on Wednesday, I guess. But I think those are that, what does it mean to, if you say you have to let people opt out, is that religious discrimination? Is that discrimination against faiths that that they really do believe that faith should be a part of everything? That's not something we address in the project.
I think it's a really interesting question. I like it quite a bit. And maybe I would just add that I can imagine circumstances where maybe somebody would have a constitutional claim that their access to public benefits is conditioned on their being willing to participate in religious activities that they find theologically problematic. But to the extent that's true, I think the remedy is not going to be anything on the Carson v. Macon side of the ledger. I think that's just a question about government's obligation to provide some sort of alternative. And the government always has an alternative, meaning, I guess the hypothetical presumes that the benefits are being provided, and Nicole already prefigured this, the benefits are only being provided by private institutions, and the only institutions are religious institutions. And if that's all true, then maybe the government's making an error about the vehicle via which it's chosen to provide a public benefit. And maybe it has a constitutional obligation. I'm thinking right now about the Free Exercise Clause, a constitutional obligation to make those benefits available, not via private institutions, but also some sort of public benefit through public institutions, so that somebody doesn't have to choose between participating in religious activities that they find theologically problematic and a public benefit. But I don't think that would impact the Carson obligation to, if you're open to private institutions, make sure all institutions can participate.
Another question from the audience. The Carson line of cases deal with generally available public benefits. The three Supreme Court cases all dealt with benefits in the form of money, grants, or scholarships. But it seems public benefits could extend beyond money programs. Thoughts on that?
Lutheran had was about recycled tires. So there are in-kind benefits. Michael gave the example of food that's going to rot from the army. That's an in-kind benefit. I think you can imagine, what if is a concern about security around, faith-based schools or schools, school security, place of worship. So those would be, in-kind benefits. So I don't really think it's, and our programs that we identify are not all about money. Many of them are about money, but some of them are sort of in-kind benefits that are being extended to everyone but religious people.
Another question, and maybe our last one, given that we're up against our time here. Can states discriminate against religion in furtherance of other anti-discrimination requirements, such as equal treatment of women, LGBT individuals, et cetera?
You can go, Michael.
I think we may all have different views on this subject. Let me try to just describe what I think, where the law is, as opposed to. So I think imagine that there's a non-discrimination provision that has existed since time immemorial, so that we're not dealing with the problem in Maine where it only comes once religious institutions arrive to the public benefit program. So long as the law is neutral and not neutral and generally applicable, at least in my view, it can't qualify as an unconstitutional condition because it is constitutional. It would be a constitutional condition. There would be no constitutional violation. So in the main, that's a funny joke. In the main, I would think that you could have non-discrimination provisions. And again, in theory. The puzzle you get to, I think, and maybe this is where, you know, I don't know, we've chatted about this before, is when you run into other versions of free exercise claims or free exercise and establishment clause claims when you hit things like the church autonomy doctrine. So, for example, I don't think the state could condition participating in a government funding program on saying that you will not discriminate in the hiring and firing of any of your faculty based on race, sex, national origin, et cetera, because what that would mean is a religious school, which has the constitutional right under the ministerial exception to hire and fire for any ministerial employee, they'd be giving that up. And I think this is just the way the doctrine would work right now. I don't think I'm adding anything. They'd be giving up a constitutional right at that point, the ministerial exception, which lives under both the free exercise and establishment clauses, in order to get government funds. And then you would have, I think, you'd be using money to purchase purchase back some sort of constitutional right. And I think that would likely go to the core of the unconstitutional conditions doctrine, I think, on most views of the subject. There's some line drawing in here. What about students? What about faculty? There are also some interpretive issues. You can imagine the statute saying that you can't discriminate, but maybe you should read that statute except for instances that are protected by a constitutional provision. So I think there's some line drawing in there, but I think that's the basic way the law would work. And now I'm looking forward to two smarter people.
So I actually would say, I think that's probably right. Although I think about it a little bit differently. I think the church autonomy doctrine, whatever it is, it clearly extends to the hiring and firing of ministers, including teachers who are charged with teaching the faith. That's just not waivable, or you might say the court lacks jurisdiction over those decisions. So you can't condition it. It's not something that can be given up. And in fact, it's interesting, in some of these ministerial exception cases, that sometimes the schools are getting money and no one's even considering that. So I think you probably can't. I do think the big question is, what's the scope of those, of the church autonomy doctrine? You mentioned student admissions. I mean, Jewish schools typically, especially in the Orthodox tradition, only admit Jews. What if they said you couldn't discriminate in student admissions? Would that be part of the church autonomy doctrine? Would it be discriminating between Jewish schools and Catholic schools because we would be glad to take Jewish students? So I think like those are the hard, hard questions. I just don't think it's waivable, so it can't be a condition. I don't know. That's a slightly different take.
Great. Well, thank you both so much, and thank you to our audience. I apologize. There were a couple questions we didn't get to, but we have gone for the full hour. The website, again, is religiousequality.net. We've covered a lot of ground about federal and state law and some Supreme Court cases and some challenging hypotheticals, and I'm grateful to Professor Garnett and Professor Helfand for their participation in it. Go to the website, look at your state, and learn about these issues in different parts around the country. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Michael. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.